Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. What if there was a relatively simple, cost-effective way to feed the world, reduce pollution, pull carbon from the atmosphere, protect biodiversity, and make farmers money to boot? According to geologist David R. Montgomery, the answer is right beneath our feet. In his new book, Growing a Revolution, Bringing Our Soul Back to Life, David talks with numerous farmers who focus on rebuilding the health of their soil through complex crop rotations, growing cover crops, reducing the use of chemical fertilizers and pesticides, and foregoing the use of the plow. This morning, we talk with David about the farmers he met in the course of researching his book and lessons they can share with farmers around the world. David, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Hey, well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
Well, a few years ago, I met this couple. They were aspiring young farmers who were living outside of just outside of Portland then in search of permanent farmland. And the guy had been reading a lot of Wes Jackson and actually turned me on to a lot of stuff I never knew about. And so we asked him what he wanted to grow, and he says, I want to grow dirt. I want to be a dirt farmer. And then he explained to me what he meant. So why don't you tell our audience, what did Connor mean by he wants to be a dirt farmer?
Well, you know, what I suspect he meant is that he wanted to rebuild the fertility of his soil and to actually improve the land so that it could produce better crops into the future. That he basically wanted to cultivate the beneficial life in the soil that would then, in turn, help cultivate the plants that a farmer wants to grow.
So how do we do that? And well, let's get, first of all, into why farmers are in such dire need of doing that in this late day in the 21st century.
Well, you know, if you look at what the state of the world's soils, we've degraded over 50% of the world's cropland to a degree, about a third of it to the point where it's no longer in agricultural production, if you look at sort of 1940, 1950 as a baseline. And if you think about the problem of feeding the world into the future, you know, having as much cropland and grazing land and rangeland in as good a state as we can get it for producing food is going to be increasingly important as the human population goes up. And so we've got this situation where we've been degrading the very basis of what it takes to support an agricultural civilization over the long run. And what people who say they want to be a dirt farmer or a regenerative farmer or someone who builds soil or builds soil fertility is really latching onto is the idea that there are ways to farm that could help build the fertility of the land as a consequence of even intensive farming. Whereas if you look backwards through history, what we've mostly done is essentially mined soil fertility, you know, either slowly or quickly, depending on the setting and the context and the civilization. But that can't go on forever if there's only a limited supply of organic matter in the soil or even of soil itself on the surface of a landscape.
What do you mean by mining the fertility of the soil?
Well, if you think about what sets the fertility of the soil, a lot of it boils down to organic matter and the life in the soil that helps cycle the nutrients out of the mineral particles, the clays and the silts and the sands that are in the soil, and get those elements into the living world of biology, and that organic matter in the soil is the fuel that feeds the microbes that drive that great engine of recycling that turns once living matter back into the raw materials that can be reincorporated into new growth, and also that helps crack those nutrients out of the rocks and get them into the world of biology. And so one of the things that our conventional agricultural practices, and even some ancient ones that involve the plow that go way back, have done over time is that the more we farm, the more we degrade that organic matter, the more the soil erodes off the surface, and we're drawing down the ability of the land to actually support farming in the future. And that's what I mean by essentially mining that fertility, is that we're using up the potential to grow future crops in order to grow crops today.
Well, before we continue, I just want to give you a little heads up, because a couple of the points that you have about how to restore soil fertility, I totally agree with you about and have seen it in practice with farmers that I know in the Willamette Valley. But your whole issue about no-till agriculture is something I want to debate a little bit as we get to that. So just so that you know that, that's going to be coming up a little bit ahead. But I want
to... Happy to do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, because I have a feeling that we may come to agree even on that.
I suspect so, because I've had some interesting changes in thought myself on that.
But first of all, I want to talk about crop rotation and cover cropping, which is essential to every sustainable organic, whether it's certified or not certified organic farm. That's a really big part of restoring soil health. So let's talk about how that works and why that's so important.
Yeah, you know, those practices, crop rotations and having a diversity of crops and using cover crops are things that have been integrated into traditional practices in many societies and that are also foundational to, you know, to permaculture and biodynamic farming and a lot of organic farms. And what, from my perspective, what it, a lot of it boils down to is these are things that actually promote the development of organic matter and that help cultivate the beneficial soil, the beneficial life in the soil that then can partner with the plants to reinforce their health and to build fertility of the land. So they became traditional practices because they really worked. They actually really help to sustain fertility because they'll build up. They enhance that nutrient cycling that, you know, the next generation of crops needs to keep going. excuse me.
We're both actually having the same problem, I think, though. I'm trying to cough off mic, so.
Yeah, no.
So between the coughs, we will finish the interview.
It's an awkward time.
Right. So, let's talk about cover cropping, because one of the things I understand about cover cropping, which is really important, is particularly if you cover crop with a nitrogen fixer, that's a really great way to restore your soil.
Yes, no, absolutely. I mean, the two things that are really sort of central to restoring soil is getting more carbon and more nitrogen into the ground. And cover crops are a good way to do both. And with the carbon part of it is that you can, if you grow the crops and then you kill them and knock them down, you can reintegrate them in, you can get that organic matter back into the soil. And crops like legumes that actually partner with microbes in their root zone to fix nitrogen really can help build the nitrogen, the plant available nitrogen in the soil. And some of the farmers that I visited were able to, you know, essentially replace their dependence on synthetic nitrogen fertilizers with integrating legumes into their cover cropping. They sort of completely replaced their dependence on chemical fertilizers by using this more biological and ecological source.
Now, what about crop rotation? Because there's a lot of different kinds of crop rotation. I know farmers in the Willamette Valley who are grass seed farmers, they rotate between grass seed and wheat. And I think you talked about, I guess it's in this Corn Belt, farmers rotate between soybeans and corn. So what's the difference between that kind of crop rotation and the kind of crop rotation that actually serves to restore and rebuild the soil?
Well, you know, a more complex rotation of like 3, 4 or more species in the rotation or a diversity of crops that are actually growing at the same time in a field, you can kind of rotate in time or space in that sense. Really help to get different mineral elements out of the soil. You can think of like a native grassland or prairie in the Midwest with all those different species that are in it. They're each going down to different levels in the soil with the roots, and some of them are partnering with mycorrhizal fungi in the soil, but some of them are getting particular elements in higher concentrations out of the soil particles and bringing them into the world of biology. And so if you have a diversity of crops doing that in a field at one time, you're bringing a wider range of nutrients back into the world of biology. And if you have a diversity of crops in your rotation in the same field at different times or different seasons or over different years, one of the things that really helps to do is cut down on the need for insecticides and pesticides. Because think about if you plant corn in the same field year after year, and one year you plant corn and then some corn pests, some root borers or something show up and start to infest that field, if you plant corn in that field again next year, what you've really done is set the table for the offspring of the pests that landed there the year before. If, on the other hand, those pests are born into a field of barley or wheat or some other crop, you've really sort of taken away their opportunity. You've denied them the niche that they need to then thrive. And that kind of ecological thinking, that kind of strategy, really underpins part of the way to farm that uses far less of those chemical inputs, and that can help cultivate and benefit the life in the soil that can be very much disturbed by the application of them.
Well, how frequently do you think farmers should be rotating their crops? As it sounds like almost with corn, you'd want to be not planting corn more than once a year, depending on what kind of weed pressure and insect pressure there is.
Yeah, and rotating, you know, 3 or 4 or more crops in a rotation so that, you know, in between corn crops, there's a couple other things that are grown so that you don't have an opportunity for those corn pests to move back into the field or for their offspring to do really well before you've got something else that something else will come in. So it's kind of a keeping them off balance approach, and I've been really impressed by how well that's worked on some of the farms that I've visited, where by adopting both the cover cropping and the complex rotations, and we can get back to the no-till part, but by adopting those two pieces, they've really been able to greatly reduce their fertilizer use from the use of cover crops with the legumes included, and greatly reduce their herbicide and insecticide use based on rotating crops in a more complex pattern in rotation. And the savings that the farmers get by using far less of those chemical inputs has really translated into much better farm economics, and had the benefit that it helped rebuild their soil.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with David Montgomery, who's author of Growing a Revolution, Bringing Our Soil Back to Life. And we're talking about how to restore soil fertility and why it's such a major issue right now in terms of how to feed the world. Well, let's get into no-tillage farming now. Why do you say, in the beginning of the book that the plow is basically the cause, the root cause of our lack of soil fertility? So why is that the case?
Well, if you look back through history, there you can make a very solid case that relying on the plow has led to the loss of topsoil in society after society around the world. And 10 years ago, I wrote a book called Dirt, the Erosion of Civilizations, that went into that case and looked at the archaeological evidence and of soil erosion and how that had affected societies around the world. And as I wrote that book, what I realized I was writing is a history of farming, because I thought I was writing about soil erosion, and it turns out that the main cause of a lot of the topsoil loss that still impoverishes areas around the world, like Libya and Syria today, was due to reliance on plow-based agriculture for a long time. And so why would that work? Why would the plow be cast as the villain in that story when it's this iconic, you know, tool in agriculture that literally helped set the stage for the rise of civilizations? And the connection is really rooted through the way soil erosion works. And that's something that, as a geologist, that I've studied for a few decades now. And the problem with the plow, in a nutshell, is that it leaves the land surface bare and vulnerable to erosion by wind or rain right after you plowed and before the next crop comes in. And why is that a problem? Well, think about where most of the fertility is in a soil. It's in the topsoil. It's in that mineral and organic matter rich zone right at the surface of the soil. And so if you're eroding your soil, you're losing it off the top, and you're losing the best stuff first. And so societies that have relied on plow-based agriculture have had, you know, a limited run at farming before they literally plow through their natural endowment of fertile soil, which kept them in business in the first place.
One of the things that I noticed in your book, when you talk about all these examples of no-till farming, that they're all actually not organic farms. In Rodale, in one place, the one organic farm that you cover, they use limited plowing, but they still do plow once every three years. And I was questioning the no-till philosophy or practices, because I've spent a lot of time on some farmers in the Willamette Valley and talked to farmers, this is long before I read your book, about no-tilling and their experiences with it and why they thought it didn't work in the Willamette Valley. So after reading your book, I emailed Harry McCormick, who started Oregon Tilth and has a farm, Sunbow Farm, in Philomath, Oregon, and asked him his thoughts on tilling. And I wanted to share this with you, and then we can sort of put together Harry's take on, is this is particularly in no-till for growing produce and for organic farming. And we'll see if this jives with what you have experienced or what you've learned from the people you've talked to. So Harry McCormick says, tilling of any kind is a very complex issue. For instance, if you are growing carrots, potatoes, garlic, etc., just the act of harvest is a very harsh tillage. Pulling weeds is tillage if the weeds have any root mass. My tillage is done with a Dutch spade, or it is a tool designed with the microbiology and worms, etc., in mind. But disturbance changes biology. Conventional tillage with a moldboard plow and disc harrow, Culpactor, is the worst, next to rototilling. So he's not a big fan of some of the more conventional kinds of tilling either. Shepard Smith and I talked about no-till experiences the other day. He sold large amounts of compost tea to two of the chemical no-till farmers we met to help them build biology. Problem with no-till, usually chemical farmers, is that the herbicides, fungicides, and other sides that they end up using causes damage to the biology that is cumulative over the years. Farming of any kind is not an old-growth forest against which we often measure soil biology. Farming is invasive. Well-managed is less invasive. Where we do no tillage on this farm, what some would term permanent pasture or grass, the soils have gone from too wet 2 to 3 weeks ago to very dry today. He wrote this to me before it started raining again and hard. If I were to try to open these fields this year for a grain crop or something, I'd have an interesting task. If you're growing a range of plant-based foods for human or even animals, and you're going to be doing at least some tillage, the biology imbalances generally stem from disturbances of fungi. So you have to use either compost or compost teas that have been tested to show high fungal of a number of species, and we generally feed foliar foods that have devoured that are devoured by fungi as well as bacteria. Most people I know think that no-till is too challenging where you have 40 to 60 inches of rain a crop year, and this year we've had more, and no rain for 4 months of the year. So one of the things I really gleaned from communicating with Harry McCormick is that no-tillage is a real challenge in the kind of wet climate we have in the Willamette Valley, and it's a strange wet climate because it's really wet for 8 months out of the year and really dry for 4 months. So I know that in your book you're looking at a lot of flexible scenarios, and I wonder how you would, if you still think that no-tillage would work in a climate like the Willamette Valley.
Well, the short answer is yes, but you'd have to adapt it because there's a lot of things that you just went through, and the idea that pulling a carrot up is tillage is something that I find a bit surprising in terms of a definition, because usually I think about it in terms of plowing, which is basically what I wrote about. And you can do no-till vegetables if you're not plowing. So there's this definitional issues of what you actually consider tillage. But what I really liked about what he said was that the idea that if you're basically trying to cultivate the beneficial organisms, the mycorrhizal fungi, whether you're inoculating them, introducing them, or feeding them, there's different strategies for doing that. And a moldboard plow really disturbs them a lot. That's one of the other big problems with plowing and tillage. So if you think about tillage through the problem of soil erosion, the act of pulling a vegetable up, pulling that carrot out of the ground is not a terribly big deal. The act of sending a plow across a field is a huge game changer. And so in that sense, you could think of degrees of tillage. One of the points that I made in the book is that we need to take these sort of three general principles of minimizing disturbance of the soil, integrating, keeping it covered so that it doesn't erode, and integrating a diversity of crops into it, and adapt that to different environments and climates. So the same kind of, say, no-till agriculture that would work in the Dakotas on some of these farms that I visited there, these huge farms there, those same methods, the same practices, wouldn't necessarily work in a place like the Willamette Valley. But if you take those basic principles of don't be disturbing the mycorrhizal fungi, covering it up and growing a diversity, one could experiment with adapting, well, what is the way to actually make that work in that environment? And the other very major issue that comes up with no-till is that if you look at no-till farming across most of America today, a lot of it depends on herbicides instead of the plow, because the plow actually makes for very good weed control, which is one of the reasons it has been very popular in society after society. But a lot of no-till today depends on heavy applications of herbicides, particularly the herbicide glyphosate. And why? Well, it provides really good weed control. One of the things I did in visiting a lot of what I like to think of as formerly conventional farmers that are now what I like to call organic-ish farmers, because they use so little glyphosate, so little fertilizer, and so little insecticide that they're almost organic, but there's cultural issues, I think, but with many of them about not wanting to be organic farmers, even though their practices have almost converged, not quite, but almost. They've developed ways and technologies, methods, and practices that allow them to get very effective weed control by using their cover crops. And so they've been able to essentially replace their dependence on herbicide in a no-till system with intelligent, more ecologically thinking managing of their cover crop sequencing and how they're actually planting, killing off the cover crops and then harvesting their crop. So, and that's one of the reasons I went to the Rodale Institute for an interview there, is to look at, ask the question, can you do this style of no-till farming today and do it in an organic system? And the interesting thing there was that they were able to do that, but they have perennial weed problems that they do a bit of tillage, about a bit of plowing about every third year to try and knock those perennial weeds down. And that's what the gentleman that you were quoting was talking about. Farming has a natural succession, and that's exactly the problem. I mean, he's exactly right about that, where you're trying to manage, you know, the system to sort of keep it back so that you don't get those perennial weeds coming up and dominating the fields.
So it sounds like, I mean, that's the impression that I got from reading the section of your book about the Rodale farm, is that no-till, pure no-till is not going to work on an organic farm because of the issue of perennial weeds. And it sounds like there's other issues here with the Willamette Valley. I mean, I also heard back from another hairy farmer in that I'm friends with in the Willamette Valley, who is, he's converted from being a conventional grass seed and wheat farmer to growing a lot of organic grains. And the first conversation I had about no-till was with him about 4 years ago, and he said he tried it and it doesn't work, and he says that the soils are just too clayey. I mean, and they're heavy soils. And
yeah, that's the environment where you hear the most complaints about no-till farming, are people who are farming on heavy clay soils. And the same is true in England, in the farmers that are doing farming there. And so one of the things I think that you could think about is, like with the Rodale Institute, they call their practices organic no-till, and so they're basically making it work, but they're doing a little bit of tillage every now and then. I think what you could do is think of it in terms of minimizing the disturbance of the soil as the operational principle, and no-till is simply one way to go about doing that.
I mean, I followed Harry, the grass seed farmer, now organic grain farmer, when he was planting beans, and he actually used a drill to plant the beans. So mm-hmm. That's a form of no-till.
Yeah.
And so it worked for the beans, but it wasn't working for the grains.
Well, in terms of his planting, or in terms of
the soil just got too compacted. He said it just wasn't working. He wasn't getting very good crops using no-till for growing grains.
Well, I'm actually surprised that you'd get compacted soil with no-till, and it sounds to me like there's an opportunity there to start thinking about how to actually operationalize a minimal disturbance scenario for not just the beans, but for other crops there as well.
Yeah, well, I don't know. He tried, and he wasn't happy with it. So my sense is that I think there's a lot of very good information in what you're saying, but I'm not sure how evenly it applies in every location and every bioregion. And
well, actually, one of the main points I make in the book is that the general principles of minimal disturbance cover crops and the diversity rotations really are generalizable, but the mechanisms, the practices that you would actually use to implement them, like the way that we're here defining no-till, is that's a practice that you would adapt to different areas in terms of the what that minimal disturbance would be. And so there was a farmer in Ohio that I visited who was using radishes as essentially a way to break up his compacted soil and to use radishes as a substitute for plowing, because they would drill into the soil, break up the hard surface layer, and eventually loosen the soil up through generations of crops.
I wanted to talk about another issue in your book, which was could be rather controversial, and that was the idea of what in some countries is called night soil. But basically, as you say, I think the title of that chapter is Closing the Loop. So it's basically one of the big issues in commercial farming, large-scale commercial farming, is the separation of animals from food crop, from grain and produce. And so we waste all this wonderful cow manure by basically polluting. It's a big issue here in Oregon because of we have one of the largest cow feedlots, dairy feedlots in the United States, just about 100 miles east of Portland. So there's those huge, you know, lagoons of cow waste that could be, if applied properly, great nutrients for the soil. So how do we close the loop? And I guess some of the concern that was raised, I mean, I was reading the part about, there's two parts to it, actually. Well, I was reading the part about using human waste, which I know is, my understanding is much harder to break down to make it healthy than if it's organic cow waste, it would probably be not a problem. But when you deal with cows that are getting a lot of antibiotics, it's probably a big issue.
Yeah.
And then the other issue is sewage sludge being used. There's been a big issue about whether organic, something that's organic farming can use sewage sludge. And I think the final organic USDA rules ban sewage sludge. But sewage sludge is not looked upon very kindly by organic farmers. So how do we deal with those issues when we're trying to close the loop, as you say?
Yeah, no, those are great questions, and they're really big issues, which is partly why I gave it a whole chapter in the book. And one, you know, the sort of the foundational piece of that that got me into thinking about that is that if you look back at the intellectual godfather of the modern fertilizer industry, a gentleman named Justus von Liebig, who's greatly credited with the idea that we could use chemical fertilizers to enhance the yields of our crops, he wrote a second book that, after the one that we all know him for, near the end of his life, that basically made the argument that we needed to return organic matter, whatever was grown on a farm and then exported for somebody to eat, or for livestock to eat, we needed to return that organic matter back to the farm to, in his words, sort of close the loop on nutrients so that we were not depleting what was available for the crops and for their health and to grow. And he was thinking in terms of systems of cities and farms where food would go from the farms into the cities and then sewage would go from the cities back out to the farm. And that was sort of the root of that style of thinking. And there's long practices in cultures back from ancient Greece to many parts of Asia where human waste and urban waste were composted and then returned back to the fields. And this is an idea that makes sense in terms of closing the loop, but there's obviously all kinds of practical considerations to do with, well, what's in it, what about the pests and pathogens, how do we treat it, how should we basically do that? And one of the places that I visited in writing the book was the city of Tacoma's sewage treatment plant, where they've basically converted it into what they like to call a soil factory. And they're taking all the city's sewage, and they send it through their treatment plant that has both an aerobic and anaerobic microbial digesters, and then they compost what comes out the other end of the plant, and then they sell it back to urban gardeners, and they also sell it to farmers. And I was actually pretty impressed with what they've got. A lot of the problems with, say, pharmaceuticals and antibiotics, the multiple digesting and the composting, takes care of most of that stuff, and they obviously can't test for absolutely everything, but they do rigorously test it and keep track of it. The part that's really hard to get out would be heavy metals. And so what they did is they applied a very aggressive campaign to get heavy metals out of the urban waste stream so it just wasn't in there in the first place. And there's all kinds of issues in terms of how one, you know, what the feedstock for that kind of material is, how it's treated, and then what do you do with it? Do you take it back to farms? Do you use it on urban soils? Do you apply it in forested environments? And how much do you use where? All kinds of issues that sort of go into and talk a bit about in the book. But if you think about all the organic matter that's in cities, whether it's that 30 or 40% of our food that we don't actually eat that gets wasted, or all the stuff that comes out of us that's organic matter. In the broadest sense of things, that's a resource that could be used to help restore the fertility of our land. And the question is, how do we go about doing it, and what are the safe ways to do it, and how much benefit could we derive from it? The one that I found real numbers on is the cattle manure one that you started with and mentioned. Because if we took all that the cattle manure that we currently stockpile in great sewage lagoons at, you know, these large stockyards and confined animal feeding operations, you could actually replace all the fertilizer that's used to grow corn in the United States if we used that, if we composted and returned that cattle manure back to the land. And if you think about how best to do that, it's probably through dispersing animals back onto farms rather than concentrating them in these large confined operations. Because once you concentrate it, it's pretty difficult to truck it around and spread it around. If the livestock, though, were grazing crop stubble on farms, they would be helping to manure those fields and returning fertility to the land in ways that could greatly reduce our dependence on chemical fertilizers.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with David Montgomery, who's author of Growing a Revolution, Bringing Our Soil Back to Life. And in the last part of this interview, I want to look at how we get to this point where you just described, where we break down the big farms into smaller units and reintegrate animal husbandry with growing crops. There's an awful lot of forces going against that, and And actually, that was the part of the book that seemed to me to be the most utopian and the least based in reality. If you live in a little bubble like we do here in Portland, some of us, and we just shop at farmers markets and know a bunch of organic farmers and small farmers, we think we're solving the problem. But of course, these farmers are feeding a very small part of the world. So how do we counter the belief, and not just the belief, but the practice that the only way to feed the world is through big ag? And how do we sort of counteract the forces, the drug companies and Monsanto-type companies that are very invested in all the pharmaceuticals and the chemicals that go into current farming?
Yeah, no, those are great questions. One of the things I was very impressed by in visiting farmers around the world, from these small subsistence farms in Africa to 20,000-acre farms in the Dakotas, are that these general principles of minimal disturbance, cover crops, and a diverse rotation scale up. So you can do it in big ag. You can do it on a 20,000-acre farm, and some of the ones I visited had reintegrated livestock onto large operations like that. And they did it by having the livestock, the cattle, graze the cover crops that had been growing after the cash crops. And so I think that there's some ways to think about that in terms of scale that are a bit unconventional in the way that we tend to think of things. But the thing that gives me some optimism about that these ideas may be able to start catching on is that, to a person, the farmers that I visited who had adopted this full suite of three things, and you mentioned earlier some of the farmers who had trouble with pieces of this, but the ones that I visited that had done all three of those elements and had stuck with them for a few years to let it play through and actually start building up their soil life and rebuilding fertility, had found that they could so much reduce their expenses for fertilizer, herbicide, and insecticide. They were dropped by 50% to 90%, was the sort of the range of reductions that I found. And they also used far less diesel when they went to no-till on these large operations in the Midwest. That saved them so much money that they were way more profitable, because they would have a little dip in yields in the first couple of years, because if you have a field that's been fertilized with nitrogen fertilizer for 100 years and then you stop doing that, you're going to get a dip in your yield. You've got to basically start rebuilding the nutrient cycling based on the microbial life. But once they did that, they got through that several-year window, their yields came back up to about what they were before with conventional practices, but their expenses were so much lower, they were really excited about it, and they were way more profitable than their conventional neighbors. And why is that? You look at commodity crop prices in the U.S., and they're actually pretty depressed. They were all complaining about the price of corn and the price of wheat, and in part because farmers have gotten so good at growing those crops that there's an abundance of them. But what's happened to the cost of all the inputs, the diesel, the fertilizer, the herbicide, the pesticides? Those have gone through the roof in the last 50 years. And so farmers are caught in the middle, and I think there's a real opportunity to try and innovate how to adapt these general principles to practices in different regions. So to figure out what works in Western Oregon, figure out what works in Pennsylvania or in the Dakotas, because it won't be the same thing in those three places. But to try and figure out how to adapt that such that you could rebuild the profitability of farms while greatly reducing their chemical use. And it's that combination, that conflation of practices that are both good for the farmer's bottom line and for the environment, that gives me hope that we could actually see a much greater expansion of this kind of regenerative farming in the future.
Well, it seems like a whole lot also is dependent on the Farm Bill, which with the current Congress and the current president is rather, and I don't know if you finished your book before the election last year, because I think that with the current political situation, at least as it is right now, who knows what it'll be like in 6 months, is really very forbidding for a lot of the movement towards sustainable agriculture that you write about in the book.
Oh, I agree completely. I mean, a lot of the policy recommendations I made in the last chapter of the book were ones I was hoping to see adopted in what became the current administration. We may have to wait a little bit for some top-down policy encouragement of these style of practices. And so for the moment, I think that what gives me some optimism is the idea that most of the momentum I saw out in the Midwest was from the bottom up, was from farmers, was driven by the farming communities of people who had adopted these practices found that they really worked and were attempting to try and educate their neighbors about how they might be able to change as well.
Actually, one other practice I wanted to just briefly talk about, and it may be the wrong time of the interview to do this, that I had some issues with was the mob grazing that Gabe Brown does on his farm and some other farms you talked about. Mm-hmm. I did a show a number of years ago where it featured a book that was called Cows Will Save the World or something like that.
Cows Save the Planet, I think it was.
Right, and she goes singing praises of Alan Savory, who came up with this idea, who's now a South African, actually... he's from Rhodesia. Well, he was from Rhodesia, and he fought the revolution. His politics seemed a little weird, and now he's ensconced in New Mexico, where the buffalo never roamed, still suggesting that we do this mob grazing in places where there never has been mob grazing. She also spent a lot of time on Gabe Brown's farm, and I believe, it sounds like both you and she saw this incredible soil fertility, but I've read a whole bunch of things about mob grazing, and I'm not convinced that it's really the panacea that people see, and it seems like it works on a small scale, possibly, when you don't have that many cows, and it works in not a wet climate and not a dry climate, and certainly doesn't work. It shouldn't work west of the 100th meridian, but that there are so many issues with the damage that cattle do on a large scale to grasslands and to the soil in general. That and also that Alan Savory, it turns out, has never really gotten any peer support from scientists, soil scientists, about.
Well, he's also made some pretty astounding, shall we say, claims about how much carbon you could put in the world's grasslands by those techniques.
Right.
I don't, the idea that could completely offset fossil fuel emissions, I don't put any credibility into myself.
I noticed you only mentioned him once in the whole book, so that was reassuring that you're not an Alan Savory devotee.
I did my some of my PhD work out in the Marin Headlands in California and was able to document that the valleys out there were filling in for 10,000 years with sediment, sort of piling up in the valley bottoms. And then the Spanish introduced cattle, and the valleys unzippered right on back down to bedrock within, decades. And so, to me, when I started writing this book, the idea that, that cows could save the world was kind of like, yeah, really? What are you talking about? I was thinking, no, cows cause erosion. By the end of visiting Gabe Brown's farm and Neil Dennis's farm up in Saskatchewan, which had done similarly remarkable transformations of his soil by adopting these mob grazing techniques, I was starting to think that, maybe the real problem with livestock is not simply having cows or a lot of cows. It's the style of grazing being maladapted to the landscape. So in the western plains where both Gabe and Neil Dennis are, the idea of trying to emulate the mob grazing style of the buffalo may make a lot of sense ecologically in terms of how those soils evolved. But the kind of grazing that the Spanish did in coastal California, where you had cattle that were, high concentrations of cattle always in the valley bottoms, because that's where the water was, that caused the landscape, the valley bottoms to fall apart. It was incredibly destructive. And I would imagine that, the right way to look at this is to think about how you would adapt the grazing practices in that continuum between high intensity and the duration of grazing. And the mistake the Spanish made was they did high-intensity, long-duration grazing on the valley bottoms. What I really like about the Gabe Brown and Neil Dennis approach that they picked up from Alan Savory is that in their landscape, the idea of having a high disturbance, but then you let it sit for a long time before you let the cows come back, it actually makes a lot of sense when you think about how the grasslands there were built in terms of what the plants do. When the cattle intensively graze them, they put out a lot of exudates into the soil to recruit the microbes that will bring the micronutrients back to those plants and rebuild the plants, and that ends up building the soil organic matter up a lot. They've virtually restored their soil organic matter back to the native prairie levels. They've gone from less than 2% back up to 5 to 8%, and Neil even has one field that was up to about 10%. And that's actually a pretty incredible transformation over the course of a couple decades.
Well, actually, we have to end, so I can't continue this, but I did read an article last night that kind of contradicted some of the theories there. And so for me, it's interesting that people have seen this work, and yet there's a lot of concerns about this is not the way soil really works. So it's an open question. I'm sure I'm going to get the same vocal response and to this discussion as the guts of the last time I talked about this on the air. So I think the
key there is that we have to adapt general principles to pick up the practices that actually work in different places. Because the mistake we've made in conventional agriculture is to think that doing the same thing everywhere will work really well. Key point I make in the last chapter of the book is we can't do that with regenerative agriculture. We can take the general principles and try and apply them everywhere because they flip conventional ones on their head. But we have to be really careful how we tailor and adapt it to the land.
Well, on that note, it's a good note to end on. I want to thank you very much for joining us, David.
Hey, well, thank you.
Sure. We've been talking with David Montgomery, who's author of Growing a Revolution, Bringing Our Soil Back to Life, and you've been listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locust-focus. Next week, we continue our conversation with Dan Egan, author of The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Robert Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Inti Illimani. Thanks for listening.